This is a podcast from Love Sport Radio.
On this podcast, we don't shy away from getting down and dirty when it comes to talking life, lust, and love. So throughout this episode, there will be strong language and adult themes.
You're listening to Wham Bam, It's Dr. Pam. Up close and very personal.
If you want strong views and real usable advice, this is the place for you. And we're getting up close and very personal with my amazing guests. This episode, I'm talking depression and alcoholism with the phenomenal Denise Welsh. And I'm talking to a rocker about his anxiety. First, this email that came into my website, drpam.co.uk. You can email me there on the homepage. And Jack says, I'm still very much in love with my wife after 5 years together. We both work long hours and I'm juggling two jobs. She still wants sex regularly, especially at the weekends, but I just don't want it anymore. I guess I lost that loving feeling a couple years back. I don't know why, and I know she's very frustrated about it. Please help. Okay, I've got to say, Jack, sexual desire issues are a massive problem. We have an epidemic with 63% of women and a similar percentage for men saying they have lost their desire. Now, people might love their partner, but they just would prefer, say, the duvet in the bedroom to getting down and dirty with that partner. And this can be serious for a relationship. A neglected partner can become angry and even stray. So listen, here's some do's and don'ts to relight your desire. First, get practical. You, Jack, and anyone listening who's lost their desire, think about any changes in your health, including has your doctor given you any new prescriptions in recent months? Because many of them dampen down desire, and they can potentially change that medication. Think about your mental health. If you're depressed or anxious, that also affects desire. Then I've got to say, what's happening in your relationship outside of the bedroom? If you're arguing, you're not going to feel like slipping between the sheets with that person. And finally, think about your lifestyle choices, because if you're a drinker or a smoker, you've got many more problems when it comes to desire, because it dampens down your circulation and it means you're not getting that kind of revved up feeling. Now, let's think about other things you can do, okay? So the first thing I'd say is de-stress and look at how you can work maybe fewer hours if you're in Jack's position. But also think about getting a bit sexier and flirtier with your partner. Go back to when you think about how you first used to flirt in your messages. You would, on your phone calls, it wouldn't all be about the day-to-day mundane things. It would actually be about you two. Well, get a little bit more of that going in your life. And even things like deciding to have candles at dinner or even a candlelit shower together. And you can start off by saying, hey, we haven't been having much sex recently, but let's just have a sensual shower together. And you're more likely to actually end up in bed than if you don't do those things. And then you have to remember that a lot of desire issue problems is about not saying what you want. People end up faking it, and then they get fed up of faking their enjoyment, and then they just, you know, their desire flatlines. So be prepared to tell your partner exactly what you want to do. And I do have my fruit tonight, and I'm going to say, like, if she tells you that she loves to have her nipples caressed. Well, I've got the two peaches here, or two nectarines actually, in this episode. And you can ask her, how do you want me to lick and kiss your nipples? What do you want me to do? And when you start doing that and you get what you really makes you feel good and turned on, then you're much more likely to have your desire rekindled. And don't forget, one of the easiest ways is thinking about the flirting, the compliments, little gifts like you used to get each other when you first knew each other, and also talking about your fantasies. Because once you sort of admit that you've got that fantasy about them being the naughty next door neighbor who comes over and asks you to borrow something, and instead you end up plunging into each other's arms and sort of having hot sex on the sofa, then you can really get your desire stimulated again. So good luck with that. And don't forget, another way to get your desire stimulated is by trying different positions. If you've done the same thing over and over for the last 5 years, like maybe Jack has with his partner, then you're not going to fancy it. So try some new positions. Okay, so now I'm glad that we've had a chance to think about your desire issues. And there's so much you can do, and I hope you take that on board. But now it's time to get up close and very personal with my first guest, who's a total inspiration and also a mega talented TV presenter, author, and actress. Not only has she played a huge range of roles like Natalie Barnes in Coronation Street to Pam in the BBC's Boys Meets Girl, but she's been my favourite loose woman and winner of Celebrity Big Brother. And she's also the author of many books, including her latest, A Mother's Bond. You can also find her on Twitter at Real Denise Welsh. I'm delighted to say hello to Denise now. Hello, Denise.
Hi, Pam.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm kind of like, I've just arrived at the next city, and it's sort of like, if it's Tuesday, it must be Norwich. I don't know where I live at the moment. This nomadic touring life is great fun with a brilliant show, but it's also exhausting.
Sure, touring it's so tough. And you know, before I get to you, I want to turn you into Dear Denise for this show, and I've got the emails to run past you. But how do you, you know, you mentioned touring. How do you keep connected to your amazing husband Lincoln and your boys? Is it just always
hard.
On the phone or messaging, or what do you do?
Well, I mean, Lincoln tries to come to see me as much as possible. But, you know, the last tour I did was 8 years ago. No, it was 7 years ago, because we gave up alcohol when we were doing it. So it was 7 years ago, and I was doing Steel Magnolias. But Lincoln was kind of between jobs at the time. He didn't really know what he was going to do, so he was able to be with me all the time.
Yes.
And that was quite lovely. But now, of course, he's a very busy international contemporary artist.
I know.
And he has his own things going on, a lot going on. So we speak all the time. And he's coming down to where I am. He's going to come down on Thursday, and you know, blah blah blah. So we just try and see each other when we can. We're both very understanding of each other's jobs.
That's crucial.
And Matthew, of course, my eldest, he's on tour with the 1975.
Yes, so, I've seen them. Like, they're incredible.
It's like ships in the night. I went to see him in Cardiff. And that was the only night that I could go. So I saw a kind of a small version of their show, because Cardiff is only a 7,000 venue. So I couldn't get to see them at the O2 or Manchester, which is gutting. You know, you can imagine 20,000 people watching your kids.
Amazing.
It's quite something.
What's it like having so many creatives in the family? Do you kind of bounce off each other, or is it a lot of passion and drama?
Funnily enough, I don't think we're together enough for there to be much passion and drama. It's probably quite a good thing, to be honest. We're very, very proud of each other. I mean, you know, I've never been someone. There's lots of actors who people will say, "Oh, I don't want my kids going into the industry."
Yeah.
If that's the way that they're leaning, and that's what they're, you know, imagine if I'd said that to Matty. You know, he's worked his, you know, what's off to become such a successful band, and Louis showing great signs of being a talented young actor. So I'm all for it. Otherwise they have to go and get a job in the chippy, and it's as simple as that.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? As long as they're earning money and doing their thing, that's fine by me.
Oh, that's incredible. Now, I realize you haven't always felt so energetic, because you've always been completely honest about your mental health issues. So tell me about what your experience has been of these issues.
Well, mine started as you know, and I've been very, you know, very public about it for 30 years. Matty's 30 and coming up, and that's when mine started. So my issue started as postnatal depression, which a lot of women's issues with depression do. I always like to make it clear that if there are people listening who are pregnant or who have just had a baby, you know, there are many women who suffer severe postnatal depression who make a complete recovery, and it never raises its head again. You know, but unfortunately, in some cases, it is the catalyst to opening up that tendency towards it. And sadly, it was with me. And so I have lived and live with a mental illness.
Yes.
But I am not defined by my illness. I have great periods of time where I am perfectly well. And it's interesting, you know, because I read so much about it. I'm writing, as you know, a book about my issues and my sobriety issues, which I'm sure we'll talk about as well, because they're all part and parcel. But when people say, you know, depression is sadness. Sadness is a normal emotion that we should be able to feel. When your mother dies, like mine did 7 years ago, when your mother dies, you are meant to be sad and grief-stricken.
Absolutely.
And that is a normal emotion that happens. That's not depression. When my mum died, I didn't get depression. I was sad and grief-stricken. Last year, on the beach in the Caribbean, year before last, I was sitting with the waves lapping at my feet, my yes. wonderful husband, a beautiful hotel, a much-needed holiday in the lap of luxury, and over an apple pie and cream, the colour started to drain from my life.
Oh, gosh.
And I can feel an attack coming on as quick as that. And within 30 seconds, my depression is on me.
Oh, my goodness. Denise, and, I mean, I think that's yeah. really important for people to realise just how you can become aware rather than thinking, what is this? I mean, for you now, you're so aware of when it descends. And that must be a good thing, because don't you know then what you need to do? Like,
well, basically, there's nothing I can... Right, so there's not once the episode begins, there's nothing I can do until it lifts. What I can do, I manage my illness better.
Yes.
Now, not that I can cure it. Giving up alcohol and drugs and self-medication things doesn't cure depression.
No.
But I stop compounding it. So, for example, there is reactive depression and there is endogenous depression. So reactive depression is when, you know, an incident in your life happens and it can induce a depressive episode.
Like a terrible divorce or something. Or
Yes, absolutely.
Trauma.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, or something that makes you, you know, anxiety, and then the anxiety starts the chemical chaos off and then you become depressed. And mine tends to be more endogenous, where I don't know when it's going to come.
Okay.
And it just comes. When it will last longer is then when something is going on in my life. So just when this last episode happened, as I say, I had no control of it coming on, but I just had a particularly traumatic time at the Christmas with a producer who had put on this sham pantomime and owed people money.
Oh, I remember,
you know,
yes.
It was a horrible time. And there was lots of ongoing legal things happening at the time. So, of course, when you get into the depressive state and the anxiety and everything's there, all of those things that you have dealt with 2 hours ago, perfectly rationally, become out of control.
And do they seem more overwhelming? And if you weren't in an episode, you could deal with it.
And then, for example, when this episode happened, I had just, after weeks of debating whether or not to, I had just accepted the role in Calendar Girls, which I knew would take me away for the best part of a year.
That must have been a bit terrifying if you were then in this episode and you're thinking, why have I done this, you know?
Well, that's exactly it. Because, you know, just before the holiday, when I accepted it, once I'd made my decision, I was hugely excited about it. Obviously, there was, I'm going to miss my family and everything. But, you know, it was a family discussion. Matthew said, Mum, I think you'll be brilliant. I think it'll be great for you. Lincoln wanted me to do it. He's so proud of me on stage and all of these different things. But, of course, when the depression hit, the panic starts about, because basically, depression, the clue's in the word, it depresses every single emotion. So it's not about that it takes the happiness away. It takes the ability to be happy away.
Yes.
It takes the ability to be sad away. It takes every emotion away from you. And it's the most isolating, frightening, horrendous feeling. It takes your ability to love away. And so
do you feel quite numb? Do you mean that?
You feel it's numb and it's black and it's dark and every little thing that you were looking forward to, you're not anymore.
Yes.
And Matty's song that he wrote on his previous album called She Lays Down describes it perfectly. And it's a very frightening illness. But, you know, it came and it went as it always does. And that's what I like to say to people. I call it my unwelcome guest who makes uninvited calls.
Oh, gosh.
Just try to learn how to tolerate him when he's there, because he will always leave.
Now, this is a profound experience that affects relationships. Now, of course, your lovely husband, Lincoln, knows that you have these episodes, your children do. What was it like, though, say, early on, though, in your first marriage, trying to explain this to your first husband? I mean, because this is where it impacts relationships so much.
It really does. And I have to say, Pam, I have been incredibly lucky. I'm incredibly lucky with Lincoln, and I was incredibly lucky in that area with my ex-husband and my mum and dad. Not one person, because you've got to remember that I went from being a happy-go-lucky 31-year-old woman blooming in pregnancy,
yes,
thrilled to be pregnant with a husband I loved, with some money in the bank, with a beautiful home in London, and, you know, mum and dad looking forward to their first grandchild, and everything in the garden was rosy on paper, absolutely. And I was blooming. My hair was great. My skin was great. I loved being pregnant. So I went from being that person that Tim married to woman in a dressing gown who couldn't move. I was almost catatonic.
Wow, that's incredible.
You know, and Tim was doing two jobs. He was traveling between Bristol and Birmingham doing two jobs. And my mum came down and had to take time off work to look after me. And you know, and as well as it being the cruelest illness ever, you've then got this child that you are totally responsible for.
And as a mother, I know it's 24/7 with a child, with
you know,
a baby.
And I always say, you know, if I hadn't had the family that I had, God knows what. And that's when we read the tragic headlines, because I was totally looked after by them. And not one of my family ever thought that this was anything other than a very serious illness. And that's why I try to reach out to the partners and the families of those who are depressed and say, this is not an indulgence. I always say in every interview, I wish that everybody in the world could experience clinical depression for 15 seconds and then for it to go and never darken their doors again, so that they could see
understand that
this is an illness.
Yes.
And not, you know, all of these. I'm doing this thing for the Beeb at the moment, this kind of just raising awareness and how the media deal with it and stuff. And we've been asked to sort of do these little, you know, 20-second videos of the type of thing people say, which is, you know, pull yourself together. You know, you could have something really serious like cancer. It's all in the mind. Why don't you just buy yourself a new dress? You've got to snap out of it and think yourself lucky. You know, all of these things, which you would never say to someone who was in bed with a terrible physical disease.
No. Never.
You would never, ever, 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 even if you couldn't understand, those of us who, God forbid, have never had cancer, can't understand what it feels like to have cancer. But we know how horrendous it is. And you would never say, well, you don't look that poorly.
Exactly. So what's wrong with you? Come on, snap out of it. Yes. I mean, it's just,
okay, you've got cancer, but you don't look that ill. You look fine to me.
And then, of course, people have told me it makes them feel so guilty that they've got depression or severe anxiety or something. And people are saying, snap out of it. Like, there's nothing really wrong with you. You've got everything in the world. And they're thinking,
oh, my God, it's got nothing.
It's got nothing to do with that.
otherwise, people with amazing marriages and everything lovely in their life sitting on a beach in Grenada, like me, wouldn't get it.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's about the chemical imbalance, which is what I have. And I chose 30 years ago when I was an incredibly lone voice in
oh, my gosh, you would have been such a lone voice. You know.
Of anybody on the telly. And I wasn't really that much on the telly. Do you know what I mean? I just used what little voice I had to speak out about it, because I just thought, no, people tried to shut me down. Sure, purely because they were concerned about my fledgling career. You know, oh, God,
don't talk about that.
People will think you're mad. They won't employ you. And I remember saying to my mum, who never said that, saying, Mum, if this can happen to me, it can literally happen to anybody. And, you know, I am going to speak out.
And that's why I have just total admiration for you and all you do for it, making people aware of what this is really like. With me, I've got, you know, seasonal affective disorder, which really strikes in the autumn, but I've got all the coping mechanisms, and it's very contained. It's not pleasant, but it is contained. And when it lifts around Christmas, because I'm one of these people where once the day even gets 5 minutes longer, I am better. I know it's such a change, but for me, at least, I know it's time limited, and I've never experienced what you're talking about.
It's still awful, though. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's still not fun. But it's
is also horrendous. It's all of these conditions that people can't see, and people go, you know, people probably say to you, yeah, but, you know, we all don't like winter, Pam.
Yes, they do say that.
But their body chemistry isn't changing.
Yeah, exactly. Mine just plummets the minute that, you know, end of September, as soon as the days are getting shorter.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk to you. You already highlighted about the alcohol feeding into mental illness. But first, I'm going to turn you into Dear Denise.
Yes.
And okay. I want to run this email past you that I received to my website. Okay. And, of course, anyone listening can email my website, drpam.co.uk, and find the contact there for the emails. Now, it says, my friends tease me a lot about the man I'm going out with. He's not a looker, but he's so sweet. I've had my share of bad boys, and I've been hurt in the past. I've pointed out to them that he's fantastic in bed, and they just say things like, well, that's because he's ugly, so he has to work harder. It's not like I can dump my pals because we've all worked together and been friends for the last 3 years. But the more I try and tell them that I really like him, the harder the time they give me. What do you suggest? Thanks so much, Kelly, and I'm 27. What do you think of that situation?
Kelly. Well, I mean, I just think, my God, who are these friends? You know what I mean? I mean, listen, Kelly, you know, I've been out with some cracking looking guys in my time, and I've been out with some who weren't as good. And the thing about it is, I always think that there are some people. I remember years ago when I was in a TV show, it shall remain nameless, and this guy came in to play one of the roles, and he was absolutely drop dead gorgeous, and we were all, you know, sort of faux swooning and stuff about this guy and going very coquettish. But you know something? He was the most boring person in the entire universe of life. And after 5 minutes talking to him, any sex appeal he had whatsoever went out of the window. And I just couldn't imagine how I had found him remotely attractive. And yet there have been some people that you literally think, oh my God, really? And then you see that person on stage or being brilliant at their job or being charismatic or being funny. And you think, wow, that's sex appeal. Sex appeal is the X factor. It's like watching something on stage. There are some people on stage and they don't have the lead. They might have this tiny little part, but your
they shine.
Eyes are drawn and you're shine to them. And I think the same thing. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm sure that they meant it as a joke when they said he has to try harder.
Yeah, they've obviously taken, you know, that what Kelly has said about them and them having meeting him. They're using this just as they think it's a bit of banter. But obviously, that must be painful for Kelly.
But banter, you know, all this, you know, I hate that thing of, it's only banter. I just know. Tell it like it is, because it usually means that they're being quite mean.
Exactly.
So I'm sure they do think it's quite funny. But you know something? If she likes him, they don't have to sleep with him.
Exactly.
So they can say what they like. She's obviously got someone who she really likes, who's giving her a jolly good time in and out of bed. So I say, go, Kelly.
Absolutely. And I say set those boundaries with the friends, just really in a stern way. I think it's come to the point where she's probably, I don't know, we don't have the detail, but she's probably just accepting all the joking and the ribbing, and she's trying to explain herself.
And you know something, it might be with a couple of them. It might be a little bit of jealousy. Okay, he may not be as good looking as their partner, but they might see him treating her like a princess and wish that they had the same kind of treatment from their fella.
Yes, definitely. So, and set boundaries with them. Just say, you know,
absolutely.
Hey, it's no joke anymore, guys. I really like this guy, and just don't talk about him if you're going to say, you know, mean-spirited things.
If you're going to say mean things, this is the guy that I love, and there you go, on your bike. Yeah.
Well, a great answer. Kelly, if she's listening now, I hope that she takes on that advice. Now, I've got another email here. It says, I'm 43 and I've been with my wife 10 years and we've always been pretty content. We both work. We have a 7-year-old boy and good friends. Things in the bedroom are fairly standard. At least I think they are for a couple like us. And we have sex about once a month. The problem is, I have a couple months ago, she read 50 Shades of Grey and now wants me to handcuff her and do all sorts. I know this book has been around ages. I never thought about it. But now that she's read it and she's asking me to do these things, I don't know what to say. I don't want to say no, but at the same time, I've never given a thought to all this bondage stuff. Please advise. Thank you, James. Okay,
oh
Denise, have you read 50 Shades? And did you tell Lincoln you were going to get that whip out?
That's absolutely hilarious. Oh, my God, my kids would just completely and utterly die. I remember not so long ago, for our honeymoon, one of our friends had given us these beautiful bejeweled handcuffs. I don't know how practical they were, but they were sort of a collector's item. And I had obviously put them in a drawer and forgotten them. And I got them out one day. And I just took a photo of them and put them on Twitter with a little saucy face or something. And my eldest son, who hates his parents being on Twitter, they hate it. And he went to me, "Oh my God, Mom, take that down. It's the most cringe thing. It's putting thoughts in my head that I don't want."
So I love
very
this.
Difficult when you have a mum who's a little bit well known and has more Twitter followers, perhaps. So, but you know something, James, you can't knock it till you've tried it, mate.
That's what I say. You only live once, and why not give it a go?
Listen, there would be many, many men would swap places with him to have a wife who is the one who's wanting to try those things, you know. And maybe he can put the boundaries in on and say, "Well, look, you know, we can try it and find out what we like and don't like and then compromise." And I'm not saying, you know, Mary, this is going to happen, whatever she's called, this is going to happen every night. But if he's only getting it once a month, then it's certainly worth a try.
Yeah. And you know, I often think in these things, when one partner suddenly brings something up, and I think that's a positive, they've obviously been thinking about it, and they're thinking they want to enhance things. But I also think it gives someone like James the opportunity to say, "Yes, well, let's try that. But I've also always wanted to try X, Y, or Z."
Exactly.
So you can do a kind of
trade-off. Because I think a lot of couples are quite, you know, they either get into a routine or they're a little bit shy about experimenting with other things. So I think it's, I think the best thing about the bedroom is to have humor. And I think that if they approach it with a humor and as a bit of a giggle, that's by far the best way. Do you know what I mean? Rather than taking it all too seriously,
yeah,
and then it could be
definitely.
A bit of cringe.
And
yeah.
If you experiment with something like that and it goes wrong and it's just funny, then you're laughing together. You're not laughing
exactly.
at each other.
Exactly. Now, so good luck.
I want to know what happened to those bejeweled handcuffs. Where are they now?
I know exactly where they are. And I'm going to keep that a secret.
Now, I want to find out about, you know, going back to what you said about, you know, with your mental health issues and how alcohol has mm-hmm. feeds into these things. And of course, recently, Lincoln had been sober for 7 years, which is
yep.
amazing. Congratulations. I wish
and mine is in a couple of months.
Yeah. And so tell me, how did you two come to that place? I know you once said to me after Celebrity Big Brother that the topless pool experience, that was sort of a wake-up call.
It wasn't really the topless pool thing. It was the whole Big Brother thing, really. It was, the Big Brother experience was a catalyst to me. The thing is, right, the myth about Celebrity Big Brother is that I was drunk in there. Channel 5 do not give you enough alcohol, or certainly didn't, to get drunk. Certainly
yes.
not with me. What I would have on a nightly basis to someone who was a drinker was like an aperitif. I was
okay.
the first one, you know, what people didn't see was I was the first one in bed every night, and I was the first one up in the morning with not one hangover. So after a couple of glasses of wine, after a really boring day, because that house is, God, so boring, you know, the people only see the highlights. They don't see the rest of the time and,
yes.
and whatever. So me getting my boobs out as a dare was actually something that was quite funny. I had no, you know, these days people go in Big Brother, they've got their boobs out within 3 seconds.
I know, and they've learned
and
from you.
You know, and I literally, Frankie Kokoza said something like, "I dare you." And I thought, why not? You know, who's going to care? The next morning, it was so inconsequential in the house that no one even mentioned it. But of course, when I came out,
it was
the worst thing that anybody could have done. You know, I didn't harm anybody. I didn't bully anybody. But of course, it was the worst thing that anybody could have done.
People were shockingly judgmental. I mean, really, honestly,
it was really horrible. But I also discovered that someone very close to me had been selling stories, and I was also, you know, before I had gone in, Tim and I had decided that our marriage, you know, that our marriage was over, but we were going to be friends, but I hadn't chosen to tell the public,
yes.
you know, and we knew the marriage was over, and Tim was seeing Joe and I was seeing Lincoln, but nobody knew, and I couldn't talk about it in there, and I shouldn't have gone in. It was a bad time in my life, and because of how lonely I was and how I was treated when I came out, I just thought, you know, I've got some changes to make in my life, and that's
yes.
when I decided to publicly announce the breakdown of my marriage, because I was so sick of the press making their own narrative about my life.
And you wanted to take back control, you know?
I wanted to take back control and say, okay, you want to hear how it happened? You know, you're all accusing me of adultery and all of this kind of stuff. And I was just fed up with it. So Big Brother was a big change in my life. And it also made me more protective of my privacy. It also made me less trustful of, well, not of my best friends, but I decided to remove certain people from my life. But I didn't think I was at that point absolutely going to give up drinking. And then Lincoln and I, we were together, and we became officially together. And the only thing that was causing problems in what was a developing, loving relationship amidst all of the craziness going round, we managed to come through and have this amazing relationship, yes, with the problems that alcohol caused.
Yes.
And I don't know if you've got friends that you sometimes look at and think, do you know something? Without alcohol, you've got a great marriage.
Yes,
you're ruining
plenty of people like that. I think there's
epidemic. And I look
issues.
At my friends and I think, you know, I even watch these. I love a bit of American reality telly. I've told you before, it's my my not so guilty pleasure. And I watch these, The Real Housewives of New York City and The Real Housewives of Orange County. And again, alcohol is a massive part of those women's lives. And every single horrible, horrendous, toxic argument happens after alcohol.
Yes, when everybody it unleashes the worst part of people who
are
angry
and
hurt.
That's what would happen with Lincoln and I. And basically, I one night said to him, "I can't deal with this. I don't like the person you are. I love you, but I don't like that person."
When you're drunk.
And he was so worried about losing me.
Yes.
He gave up drinking that day.
That's
from
having been
his friends having tried to stop him, because he ran Stringfellows. He had a very nocturnal light, so he was functioning.
Of course, and you're around all that, the boozing in a place like that.
I didn't, like many alcoholics do, consider that my problem was as bad. And I was doing a play, so I was only having a couple of glasses of wine a night and blah, blah, blah. Of course, I wasn't. I was having a bottle a night, and he was sober, and I was prodding him, you know, like goading. Anyway, long story short, 2 months later, there was a big, after the show, everybody went out, and I said to Lincoln, I've got lots of friends coming in, and don't let me get drunk, because I've got two shows tomorrow, and the press are there. And at one point, he said to me, darling, I'm just letting you know that you are getting a bit drunk, and the paps are taking pictures through the window. And what did I do? Don't you bleep and tell me what to do,
blah, blah, blah.
I had a complete blackout. I remembered nothing. And the next morning I woke up and I was plastered over the papers in a red dress, screaming and shouting.
I had
smashed up the flat, and I was, it was horrendous. And the story goes, it's become a bit of a thing that Lincoln showed me a video. He didn't. He had a video. I didn't want to see it. But it was enough to know that he videoed me.
Oh, gosh. That's so painful.
He came and picked me up from work that night. He said, I don't want you to say anything. He drove me back from Richmond to Kensington. He spoke about how much he loved me, but how, with him being sober now, it was almost going to be impossible to make this work. And I just thought, I can't live without this man. I don't mean I can't live dramatically. I mean, I don't want
to. You didn't want to
lose
live without
this man.
Him. Yes.
And I've never had a drink since that day. And well, not only is it the most wonderful thing we could have done for each other, it is the most wonderful thing that we've done for the people who love us.
And that
is what anchors us, is to see how their lives have changed as a result of us giving up drinking.
Denise, it's always phenomenal to talk to you. I love your honesty. I appreciate it so much. I wish you to, you know, every, you know, just for today, as it goes with these issues, just for today,
yeah,
that we stay sober. And people, of course, can check you out on Twitter at Real Denise Welsh. You're regularly on Loose Women. Thank you again, and lots of love to you and to Lincoln.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, bye, darling.
Okay, bye. Bye.
And that was the lovely Denise Welsh. And coming up, I am talking to a rocker about his anxiety and how that might affect his relationships.
If you have a dating disaster or an awkward issue you'd like Dr. Pam's advice on, Visit drpam.co.uk. Drop her a line via the contact page. That's drpam.co.uk.
You're listening to Wham Bam. It's Dr. Pam. Now, we're always saying that men should open up about their mental health, and it seems to be getting better, especially because men who have a platform are using it to talk about theirs. My next guest is a rocker, and he's done just that, opening up about some of these things. He's Sam Douglas, the lead singer and bassist with a band I absolutely love and have seen live 3 times. Mallory Knox. Now, the other members of the band are the lead guitarist Joe Savins, drummer Dave Rawling, and rhythm guitarist James Gillette. Now, check them out on Twitter at Mallory Knox Band and their site MalloryKnox.com. Let's hear some of Black Holes, their single from their upcoming album. Oh, I love that. Hey, Sam, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Oh, how have you been? It's been a couple of years since you and I have spoken.
It has been, yeah. Lots happened in the last 2 years since I last spoke to you, for sure. So,
I know I've seen Mallory Knox in that time. I saw you at Brixton Academy after our last conversation. And I've got to say, I love Black Holes. If that's something to go by for the new album, it's going to be a smasher. Now, I've got to ask you about the opening lyric. I rarely have a night when my mind is not running. Now, I'm sure everyone listening can identify with that lyric, because so many people kind of are getting trapped into this overthinking. So which one of you wrote that lyric?
That would be me. Oh. So, it's always me.
And so for you, you have a night, rarely have a night when your mind isn't running. So are you one of these classic overthinkers then?
I have been for a long, long time. I always find that if I've got something going in my life that I feel needs like constant attention, it's always like 25 times worse at night, where you're just kind of lying there and everything almost becomes too clear because there's nothing else to kind of distract you. And I always find I work myself up and make myself worry about things that aren't really there, if that makes sense. So I've been criminal of that for a long time now. I think I've wrote a few songs about that, you know, stuff like Shout of the Moon was the same kind of concept. So yeah, it's just a way for me to try and offload that, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And you know, I have periods occasionally, although of course in my work I know the techniques to use at night that should stop that, but there's some times when you do just go around and around in your head about whatever it is, and it's almost impossible, even when you have the techniques I have at my fingertips, to stop it. I was wondering how, besides expressing it creatively like that in your lyrics, is this something that you've actually tried things to kind of calm your mind? Have you thought about different techniques? Have you tried meditation or anything like that?
I personally haven't, no. I'm a very good at like kind of trying to put it all to one side, and then I have a week where it all kind of blows up, which is not obviously a good way to go about it. But my technique honestly has always been picking up a guitar. Like, I've not really known any other way. I've like spoke to people about it. I mean, I think it helps talking to, like, I've got my girlfriend who's very supportive of me and stuff like that. So it's good to talk to her and stuff. But then, no, I've never delved into the whole meditation side of it and things like that. Not quite yet.
Yeah. Well, that's good though. As you say though, at least it's only periods of time when you're going through that. It's not all the time. Now, I know you and the band kind of opened up, I think it was on a music station, maybe talking about kind of these issues, because a lot of people are struggling with these. And we know that, you know, under 35s, you know, for men between sort of early 20s and up to sort of mid 30s, there's a real issue with things like suicide. And some of these things can spin out of control when someone feels they can't open up. So, I mean, it's just so incredible when someone like, you know, Mallory Knox, when you guys open up about these things. Have you kind of made a conscious effort to do that, or was it something you were asked to do, or what?
I don't think, no, I think like we can't really fake our way through it, you know. I think with our music it always has to be from like a personal perspective and stuff, and I'd be lying to say if I said like we write songs to like help people out. It's not the case. Like, even in a way, like not trying to spread awareness, that's not why we write these songs. it has to kind of come from within us, and like we have to feel it, like really feel it for it to make sense to us in any way. So I love the fact that, you know, Better Off Without You on our last record kind of put us into this whole subject of like mental health. And I embrace that, and I like that people can feel like they can come up to me and say, oh, that song means the absolute world to me, or it really helped me for this time. That's amazing. But that's never why I set out to write a song. I can't fake it. Like, I like that. I know that music has the power to like kind of help people out and kind of take them away from whatever they're feeling, for even if it's just for 5 minutes, you know. So
Music
helped me out as a teen, as like, you know, still helps me now. I looked up to so many bands that, you know, without music I'd have been lost, quite honestly. Like, I'm very lucky that I fell into it myself. So the only way that I can kind of do what I do is by writing it from me. I can't do it to like help other people, but
it ends up, it has that spin-off effect.
Yeah, and like, and that's the coolest thing, because I like that our music can like make people feel the way it made me feel when I grew up listening to some of my favorite bands, you know. And if it helps them out along the way, that's just a bonus, you know. That's,
yes.
I think we're always, I'm always very open lyrically to make sure that kind of people can take what they want from it. I try not to make it so personal that it's only going to make sense to me. I think,
yes. No, I know,
I think you
know.
Have to kind of, you know, so I want people to be able to relate to it, but at the same time, I don't want it to be like me kind of singing a lie, if that makes sense. But I think you can be clever in the way that you can tell what you're thinking and like feeling, and make sure that other people can kind of relate to that, you know?
Yeah, I absolutely know what you're saying. There's a couple songs of yours, Getaway and Heart and Desire from Asymmetry, that just, I don't know why, they always make me well up. And I've never even really, like, memorized the lyrics, but there's just something in it that makes me, like, just really gets me.
Well, that whole time of, like, Asymmetry was a really interesting time in all of our lives. Like, we were 23, 24, but that was when we were heading out to America for 6 months out of the year, and we were away from home all the time, and it was stuff we'd never experienced. And at that time, like, it was all very over-emotional. Like, we were either missing family, or all of a sudden we were playing to 5,000 people in New York, and we were like, how the hell do we deal with this? Like, and I guess why that record, it covered so many of those emotions. Like, it's funny because I listened back to some of those songs, and it makes you kind of remember what it was like back then. Like, the lyrics kind of remind you and take you back to how you felt and stuff. And there's some lyrics on there that now make no sense to me, because it's like, oh God, I can't believe it was like that. But that's what I mean. Sometimes the certain sound of a song can make you feel 10 times more than a lyric would. And I think Asymmetry, those two songs that you mentioned, are like, the music tells you what the song was,
yes,
going to be about. I know that
exactly.
Sounds really hippie, but that's just how it is. So like, I always feel like if you write the music first and the music makes you feel a certain way, the lyrics soon come out after, and it brings something out of that you didn't even know was in there. So.
Well, this is the power, and I'm often recommending in my work, you know, people get their anthem that maybe gets them going, get that song that actually makes them embrace some sort of sadness that they haven't embraced, you know, whatever it is that they use music in that way. Now one thing I was thinking about band life, I would have thought that when it comes to mental health, it's really tough the way a band has to, like, say you're writing your album and then you're dropping your album and you're touring and then you have the quiet times. So life in a band is so, you know, it's intense, 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 and then suddenly you have the down months where, you know, where you did down
time.
Yeah,
you're almost going to like hibernation, so to speak.
So do you use that time? I mean, do you think, can that actually stress some people out as musicians? Or and I'm not talking about you personally, but I would have thought that intensity followed by the period of downtime is actually quite hard for some people to cope with.
Yeah, definitely. I think when I was younger, especially, when everything was like go, 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 and then you come back home and it's like, oh, wow, everything's just stopped. I did find that hard to deal with. Like, but I appreciate it so much now, so I enjoy that. I enjoy the quiet time. I guess that's just how I've grown into, like, as a person. Like, I now embrace that downtime, and for me, that's some of my most enjoyable times of being in a band, because it's when I get to write. So it's when I'm my most creative now is when we are off, you know. So when we're out touring and we're promoting the album, you know, the creativity kind of stops. Like, I joined a band to write music. It was never to play in front of people. It was never to travel the world. I'm forever grateful that I've been able to do that. But my one reason for being a musician was to write and create. And so my downtime is when I almost feel like my most active. And I think it took me a long time to figure that out. And I kind of had to, once I figured that out, it made me enjoy that side of being in a band even more. Instead of looking at it as like, oh, now I'm not doing anything for the next 6 months. I'm like, of course you are. You're going to write the next record.
But that's a great mental place to come to, because I've met a fair few rockers through my work, and I know many struggle with that downtime and turn to alcohol, drugs, whatever, to give them that kind of lift or excitement. Usually that's the thing not to do when you need a lift and excitement. You need to deal with it. Now, I've got to ask, I'm sure you follow the footy. Don't you have?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So, which team do you support?
I'm a Cambridge United fan.
Okay.
So I'm a bit of a local boy. I like my local team. So.
And do you guys in the band ever get out? I know at one point I remember, because I follow on Twitter what you guys are up to, and you were all getting out and getting more physical. And do you ever do like little four-a-side footy with each other, or what do you sort of
James,
sport?
James has got so into his like football now. He's joined the Sunday League team. Joe's a season ticket holder at Cambridge United. I go and watch them whenever I can. I follow football on the telly, but my exercise is terrible for it. I don't play it anymore. I tried playing about a year ago. We did like a soccer six tournament against like some other bands, and then like people from like, I don't know, EastEnders were there and stuff like that. And I played, it was like 10 minute halves, and I think I lasted about 5 minutes in each half, and I had to get timed out. So but we definitely do keep up with, I mean, especially James, he plays it pretty much every weekend now.
Yeah, because getting physical can also burn off that energy when people are lying there at night, so doing
definitely,
something, a sport
yeah.
they like. Well, listen, it's been amazing to talk to you, and I'm so looking forward to the album coming out later in the year. And, of course, people, as I say, can get on Twitter at Mallory Knox Band and on your website, mallorynox.com. Any way that they can connect with you?
I think Twitter's pretty much it now, isn't it? I think that's the platform that everyone likes to follow up with their favourite bands and football teams and stuff. So, yeah, I'd say Twitter. I mean, we've got Instagram and Facebook as well, but I think Twitter's your best bet.
Cool. Well, thank you, Sam, so much for your time tonight.
Wham, bam, it's Dr. Pam. Up close and very personal. If you have a dating disaster or an awkward issue you'd like Dr. Pam's advice on, visit drpam.co.uk. Drop her a line via the contact page. That's drpam.co.uk.